Welcome to Points of Departure, a podcast from the Arkansas Global Changemakers in coordination with KUAF Public Radio,
where we aim to place pressing social issues into global context
and bring communities together to find local solutions to global challenges.
My name is Lawrence Hare, Associate Professor of History in the Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences.
And I am Rogelio Garcia Contreras, Teaching Assistant Faculty in the Walden College of Business.
And I'm Daniel Carruth, a producer and reporter for KUAF Public Radio. And we're your hosts for Points of Departure.
Welcome to another episode of Points of Departure. Lawrence, how are you?
I'm doing great. And with me is our producer, Daniel Carruth. I hope you're doing well.
Yes,
he's signaling that he's doing well.
Yes. Well, we are here, and thanks to his patience and magic, these episodes are possible. And as you know, in this season, we have been discussing sustainability and development and how sustainability impacts our lives, our economy.
That's right.
And this episode is no exception. In this episode, we're going to talk to Toshiro Nakamura, who is now the founder and CEO, co-founder and CEO of Copernic, a research and development lab that essentially supports social enterprise acceleration in Bali, Indonesia. But what is interesting about Toshiro is his background, right? He was a UNDP officer, United Nations Development Program officer, and he co-founded Copernic with a former World Bank officer. So they have a very interesting perspective on what research and development means for social enterprises that want to determine whether or not the work that they are doing is actually supporting the impact that they claim to be having.
And now Toshiro joined us by Zoom from Bali, in Indonesia, and it's an interesting site for us because we send study abroad programs to Bali. And Rahil, you've led students
right.
to Bali.
I led an MBA program to Bali last year. It was fascinating, the experience, and we actually visited Copernic.
And this year we're sending our first undergraduate group to a Changemakers Bali program. So
that's right.
So we're really interested in all of the development activity that's happening there and all of the innovation that's happening there. And of course, Toshiro and his background with the UN, there's none better to talk to about this.
I believe it's a fantastic conversation. He's going to talk about the experience of running Copernic, his experience also as a UNDP official, and also the results that they have and they have had throughout the years, all the results and learning from their experiments from this R&D lab to achieve precisely the fulfillment of the sustainable development goals that exist in their catalog.
Oh, well, let's take a listen.
You're listening to Points of Departure. We'll be right back after this.
Привет, меня зовут Ольга, я учусь и работаю в университете штата Луизиана в Батон-Руж. Я слушаю Points of Departure.
Hey, it's A. Martinez. Journalists like me get into this field because we're genuinely curious people. If you listen to Morning Edition from NPR News, you probably are too. We ask questions to understand the people and world around us better. We enjoy discovering and exploring new ideas, and we don't settle for obvious answers. Feed your curiosity by starting the day with Morning Edition.
You can listen to Morning Edition broadcasts locally on your NPR station, KUAF, every weekday from 5 to 9 a.m. on KUAF 91.3. Listen at KUAF.com with an HD radio or when you ask your smart speaker to play KUAF. You're listening to Points of Departure.
Toshi Nakamura, co-founder and CEO of Copernic, thanks for joining us this morning in another episode of Points of Departure.
Thank you for having me.
Toshi, you have worked for the United Nations. You actually have been a post-disaster reconstruction officer and a peace building. You have been working in peace building processes. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your work at the United Nations and how that work set up the foundation for what you do now in Copernic?
Right. Yes, thank you again for this opportunity. So the UN was actually my dream job since I was in high school. Eventually, I got the job in Timor-Leste first, and that was in immediately after the independence of Timor-Leste in 2002. And the one of the projects that were assigned to me was to help build the state institutions from scratch. As you can imagine, Timor-Leste was not an independent country for many years. And when they regained independence, they had to have constitutions, they have to have different ministries, they have to have parliament and judiciary, etc. And so a lot of international assistance was provided to build those institutions by sending a lot of international advisors into different positions in those ministries, and then train the Timorese counterparts so that they can do their job properly. And then gradually reducing the number of those international advisors and then eventually become fully operational by Timorese themselves. So that was kind of my first project. And then also I was given this another project to reintegrate ex-combatants into society, which is typically through a job training and some financial assistance. This initial exposure in East Timor was really fascinating. And then I was so much enjoying the work. And then at that time, I was really convinced that I will work in the UN until I retire. The next assignment was in Indonesia, and that was immediately after the tsunami. I got a call from my boss at that time and said, "Toshi, can you go to Indonesia in the next 72 hours? And I said, "Oh, yes." And I went there, and I went to Aceh, where the impact of tsunami was the greatest. And I initially did the assessment together with the Indonesian government and then other organizations on the damage and loss of the tsunami. And then that led to recovery planning support for the Indonesian government. And then I was also working in Sierra Leone in West Africa. And that was at that time, the UN started the new initiative called the Peace Building Fund and the Peace Building Commissions. That was a huge experiment for the UN system to really pool the fund so that it can finance projects that prevent countries from relapsing into conflict.
So this is an initiative for positive peace, right? Peace building in the sense that you're creating conditions that prevent conflicts from arising in the first place, right?
Yes. So that was supporting the elections to be conducted peacefully and in a transparent way, and also supporting the military to have a very basic equipment, etc. And then my last assignment was in New York and supporting the UN reform process in those countries in the aftermath of conflict or natural disasters. But through this experience, I started to think that maybe there are other ways that we can bring to the development sector, namely bringing a new concept, new ideas into the equation, and then using more data to understand how our work is solving the various problems that we were trying to address. So that led to the creation of Copernic.
Well, your story is so fascinating. One of the things I notice as you're telling the story is it seems to me like you begin your career and you're in all of these projects working on, I guess, what we might characterize as short-term interventions in development, swift state building, conflict mitigation, that sort of thing. And now as you go into Copernic, you're moving into a more long-term investment, moving from the heart of development centers down into the, if I can use the metaphor, of the capillaries into the communities. Can you tell us a little bit briefly about what Copernic does?
So we are an R&D lab for social and environmental challenges, especially focusing in Indonesia. So we find the problems that needs addressing, and then we come up with potential solutions for these problems, and we actually test those potential interventions and then collect data whether the intervention worked or not. And then we share the results so that the good or effective interventions can be replicated by like-minded organizations. So one thing I probably have to add before going deeper on Copernic is that the, some of the projects that I was involved in as a UN employee, I think they are actually more longer term rather than the short term. Building a state institutions is really the foundation, creating the foundation for the country to flourish, and then also integrating the ex-combatants. Without that, there will be no recovery and redevelopment.
So without that intervention, really, there's no possibility to do the work that Copernic does now in that
That's
context,
true.
Right? Like,
yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
I think the UN, because of this impartiality, the UN tend to work a lot on the politically sensitive issues.
Right.
While the organizations like us, smaller ones, are more into kind of very specific challenges which are not that political, but faced by a lot of ordinary people in the country.
And it is precisely because of this reason, I believe, and I would love to hear your take on it, it is precisely because of this reason that your work on development is much more effective. Would you agree with that?
I don't know if it's more effective. I think we try to be more effective. And one of the things that really differentiates is that we are very rigorous about collecting data about whether the intervention is working or not. And in fact, a lot of interventions that we tested did not have very good results. Some are kind of having really mediocre results. But we take that as a really an important learning for us and then for the development sector as a whole. So we share everything, including the experiment that didn't really work out on our platform called Solutions Catalog.
This is fascinating, I think, and I believe it's super important that you do this kind of work and even, you know, obviously report back even on those interventions that are not as successful. This reminds me of the work, in a way, of Esther Duflo and this wonderful book that she wrote, co-author, Poor Economics, in reference to all these randomized controlled trials that they were conducting mainly in India to determine the true impact of an intervention. Can you speak a little bit about the methodologies that Copernic uses to do this kind of work and evaluate the interventions?
Yeah, thank you for that. Actually, the Poor Economics is one of my Bibles, and that was one of the greatest inspirations for our experimentation work. We did work with J-PAL and the Evidence Action 5-6 years ago in okay. Indonesia on the RCT. And that gave us a good idea about what it means to actually conduct the randomized control trial, which is it has to be rigorous.
Yes.
But from the experience, we thought that this is great, but if we want to test early stage ideas, and if those early stage ideas' success rate is probably much lower than the later stage interventions that the typically RCT conduct, then the way that we conduct experiments should be much leaner because we do not, nobody has the resources to do, you know, 1,000
right.
RCTs for interventions that may or may not work. So our approach is very intentionally lean, and the sample size is very small, and the experiment duration is very small, but we still collect the data, and we still try to add the control group, so counterfactual in the experiment, so that we get kind of more we call signals rather than evidence, because when we say evidence, we also tend to think about the RCT result. But those signals are quite important to see whether early stage ideas are worth going to the next step and perhaps being to be tested with the randomized controlled trial.
And is there a process for replication? Not only in terms of scale, but also in terms of locale, right? Different cultural milieus or community types. Who are your partners? How does that work?
Yeah, so let me give you one example. So we worked with rubber farmers in Kalimantan in Indonesia. And one of the challenges that the farmers was sharing with us was the loss of latex during the rainy season. So the rubber, natural rubber, is made out of the latex that you can get by cutting the surface of the trees, and then the white liquid comes out, and then farmers basically collect them in a ball attached to the tree. But when it rains, it's washed away or watered down significantly with a heavy rain. And then they will basically lose the entire latex, and they will have no income for that. And that issue seems like relatively easy to solve. And we kind of discussed with the farmers different ways of blocking the rain water to enter the bowl. And so we created this very small, like umbrella-like a shield attached to the tree. And then we basically had the 25 trees with a type A of the rain guard, another 25 trees with a different type of rain guard, and 25 without any guards. And then we collected how much data around how much latex was harvested safely. And the trees with the rain guard had over 70% extra latex collected compared to the trees without the rain guard. And so this result really encouraged the farmers to continue using the rain guard after the experiment. That's one. But the farmers in the nearby villages started to notice and, oh, that's very interesting, and let's adopt that. And eventually a GIZ, which is a German aid agency equivalent of a USAID in Germany, they also learned about this rain guard, and then they happened to have another project supporting the farmers, the rubber farmers, and they had the same issues. So they decided to adopt that in their own program and introduce a few thousands of the rain guards to the farmers that they support. So this is one of the example of replications that we wanted to see. So the experiment that we conduct is lean, but by generating the evidence and by talking about the potential impact of these solutions, we want to see other organizations tackling the similar challenges to adapt. Yeah, we started to see those examples through the dissemination of our results.
You're listening to Points of Departure. You can discover more about the topics discussed in this episode, listen to previous episodes, and more when you go online to KUAF.com. The conversation with Toshiro Nakamura will continue after this break.
Do you ever wonder what's going on while you're at work? Maybe the policy decisions happening at the state capitol, what performances are this weekend, perhaps the latest news on health, local initiatives, infrastructure, or education. Ozarks at Large is your one-stop shop for local news. Listen every day on KUAF or find the complete episodes and individual stories online at KUAF.com.
So I have a question about the ways in which you work with your communities. I wonder how involved they are in this process. How do you find your partners? How do you find the problems that you want to address? And then in what ways are your community partners involved?
So Copernic, we have between 60 and 70 staff members, but majority is Indonesian, and we work 95% in Indonesia. So that means that already the people that are with us have had a lot of experience of their own before joining the organizations. Some of them worked in different NGOs, some of them worked in different companies.
And that means they know the communities, they know the area.
They know the communities, they have their own relationship. And so from Indonesia, from Aceh to Papua, it's quite vast, mm-hmm. and then have a multiple cultures and then languages. And so having those diverse team of Indonesians is really helpful. And then, you know, some of the issues that we work on come from the suggestion from the team, right? For example, we have recently worked with coffee farmers. They were simply selling their low quality coffee beans to the middleman. And that has been what they have been doing for the last 10, 20 years. And then, so from the discussion with the team, we thought that, okay, maybe we can introduce a different practice to increase their income. And so we worked with the farmers to process, so the post-harvest processing, like drying and peeling the coffee beans. And eventually we created this end product. And so now this end product is sold in different coffee shops and cafes. So, this is just one example of the project idea coming from the teams themselves. And by working with those, we have, I guess, 20 to 30 projects at any given time.
Wow.
And through a project, we learn about different kind of challenges, right? So, I heard this another challenge that, these farmers or communities want addressed. So through that kind of existing project connections, we also start a new project.
By building your relationships, being in one space. That makes sense.
Toshi, you founded Copernic with a colleague at the United Nations. She worked also for the United Nations and also for the World Bank.
Yes.
Eva
Wojcikowska.
It's
Polish.
Thank you. Thank you. So here you have a former World Bank officer, a former United Nations officer, founding these organizations, doing perhaps similar work to what you were doing in the past. But what is really, if you were to share with us the reason for which the two of you decided to just leave these non-governmental organizations and go into this exploration of this R&D for social and environmental challenges and just explore on your own this path. What would be that reason? What motivated you to do this?
Yeah, so the UN or World Bank is a part of this official development assistance, right? So which is basically financed by the taxpayers' money and going through the, in the case of the US, it goes to the Ministry of Finance equivalent, and then they give money to different organizations.
Right.
And then from the UN side, who is the main interlocutor of the aid, which is the developing country's government? And I think that structure is important because without the proper government support, you will not have a sustainable development. But the ODA structure is so strict in that framework. So everything that we were doing was had to go through the ministry. And one of the things that I felt, especially in Africa, was that the ministry officials are really an elite in the country. And in the case of the West African country that I was working in, a lot of the senior leadership was from the diaspora community. And they were from the UK, and they came back.
Often disconnected with the reality of
the field. Often very disconnected. Yeah. They have a very different background, different financial conditions. And a lot of discussions are happening in the capital city, expensive hotels, nice food. And then, as soon as I go to the field and then see how the community actually lives, even the local government, the village government, if I go, there's no phone, and there's no electricity, there's no light, there's not even a desk. And here in the capital, we were talking about, the empowering the government to be able to plan better, etc. And I felt that there's too much focus on, or too much trust or focus on the government structure. And I felt that there should be a lot of activities, and there should be more room for more grassroots level activities to complement what this official assistance is doing. So that's one. And the other thing was that I mentioned very briefly, but collecting the data to see whether the intervention worked or not. I think because of probably the pressure, the UN and these official institutions are using the public funding. If you are using public funds and if the project doesn't work, you cannot say that, sorry, project didn't really work. But in reality, a lot of projects has not reached the desired goals.
Right.
But I think really collecting data and sharing and learning from them was so important. And so we also wanted to do that. Which was not very common in development. It is increasingly becoming more common, but still, I think less than 10% of the project properly evaluated in the development sector.
That's very interesting.
That is interesting. I mean, you're really developing a model that's working within this broader system, but it's also creating the space that you need to pursue new ideas and new innovations that are solving on-the-ground challenges.
Yeah,
somehow isolating yourself also from the political interest and the cycles of different government administrations or whatever, that's much needed in the space of development.
Well, I want to ask one more question, since you're working on the ground in the communities, and there's a lot of discussion about sustainable development. That's really where we've been focusing on in our recent episodes. I'm wondering how you see the outlook for sustainable development as a paradigm in the field for making change.
Yeah, I think this SDGs, this kind of global framework,
sustainable development goals. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, to me, it's not that new. There was, MDGs that was adopted at the millennium, and what's useful about this framework is that out of so many different challenges that the planet is facing, there is at least kind of agreed common list of challenges. And also what SDGs and MDGs was trying to do was to set the numerical target for each of those goals. So I think that is very positive. That should be, I guess, there will be the next generation goals after the SDGs. But that basic principles of identifying the priority challenges and then setting numerical goals and tracking the progress against that will and should continue. So I think it's the paradigm itself is very positive thing.
Are you optimistic about the agenda? the 2030 agenda and our ability to reach close to the goals that we have for the agenda?
I think these goals by nature is an ambitious one. So as long as we are making a positive progress, I think that's good.
I'm sure
that the next target will be also very ambitious, and we may not end up achieving all of them. But
I'm glad to hear you say that, because there are many who are pessimistic and are seeing we're not meeting the goals, and that sort of breeds fatalism about whether we can even chase after those objectives.
I mean, to me, the big development or big change only happens with a small incremental but the real changes, right? And we are focusing on finding those real small but real changes. And if that accumulates eventually, I think that will lead to a global change and then, you know, sustainable development.
Toshi Nakamura, co-founder and CEO of Copernic in Bali, Indonesia. The work that you do there is fantastic, much needed in our world today. An example and a point of reference. I always recommend my students to take a look at your website and the work that you're doing.
It's a great website.
Thank you very much for all that and for joining us in this episode of Points of Departure.
Thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity. Really enjoy the conversation.
You've been listening to Points of Departure. Your hosts are Rogelio Garcia Contreras and Lawrence Hare. I'm producer Daniel Carruth. Points of Departure is a podcast production of KUAF Public Radio and Arkansas Global Changemakers. For more on topics discussed in this episode, links, information about our guest and host, as well as previous podcast episodes, you can find all of that at KUAF.com.